Grace and Julie.
Awesome. Great. Well, this, do you want to do this intro, Julie? Are we ready
to
go?
I mean, this is it.
Let's see
this. This is the intro.
This is the intro. I'm Grace Thomas.
I'm Julie Greiner.
And this is Competitive Literature, the first episode of Competitive Literature.
Book the first.
A podcast where Julie and I compete to see who can read a book better.
Yeah. It will usually, I assume, be me that reads it better.
I think it probably will also be Julie, to tell you the truth. I really skirted by for a lot of school. We'll see.
Just for the record, I was doing that as like a joke, and I was assuming she was going to go, and it'll be me, and then I'd go, and therein lies the conflict or something. But no.
I don't know. I feel like this is actually kind of a really toxic, setup for the podcast.
I think it is.
I didn't bully Grace into this.
This was actually my idea. The concept of this podcast, and I was so excited about it, and I was so excited that Julie wanted to do this with me, and then it came to preparing for this first episode, and it filled me with like an anxiety that I haven't had in my heart for years. But I'm excited to confront it. I'm excited to work through it. I did not really learn how to read until second grade. And then I read a bunch, and then my dad died, and then I started reading less. I don't know how that all like filters
that's
in.
All, that, or, that's a very natural A to C progression. Yeah.
I think I read consistently, but like without a soul for many years.
Okay.
Like just like whatever school said to read. I will read school book.
I got in trouble when I was like 15 for reading Percy Jackson in choir. I was like 15 years old. I like just was like reading it when everyone else was singing. I don't know why I thought I wasn't going to get caught or like what was going through my head. I was being pretty absent-minded. Okay. Before we say anything else, we have to introduce our guest, one of my very good friends. You know her from the Bechdel cast. You know her from Meyer and Mensa. You know her from Robot Chicken. Jamie Loftus, everybody.
Wow.
I mean, she's been talking.
Way out of
the
turn.
Third voice has
I spoke
been
way out of turn.
No, you didn't speak out of turn. No, I'm glad
that's not my
we really ripped off Hollywood Handbook's intro style. Is what happened. we just let you talk. We didn't immediately.
And
sorry,
then just
Sean
get
and
back
Hayes.
Around to
I
it.
I think, and I mean,
they will sue. They're very litigious.
A lot
They're
of
very litigious people.
A lot of this book series too is just kind of about sitting in the unknown, right? So they didn't. The listeners don't know what's going on.
Speaking of the book series, I don't think we've mentioned yet, but this first episode, we will be talking about The Bad Beginning, the first book in the series of unfortunate events, and also the rest of the series of unfortunate events.
Yeah, you can't just talk. Once you pop, it's that kind of situation.
Yeah, yes. You can't stop. As
I suggested that. Yes. Yeah. I suggested that we read every book in the series. I might not have been successful in that, but we'll see.
I'm like nervous about how successful I was.
I did not reread every book in this series, but I feel ready.
I feel ready too.
This is the only series that I feel ready.
Yeah,
right. And it is pretty formulaic too. At least the first like half of this series is pretty formulaic. So
yeah. I don't think that there's many series that it's like, even as a kid, it's really easy to figure out that there was not an end game in mind when the series started.
Absolutely.
It really only occurs to him to not write the same book again around book six.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of it is reverse engineering. Like a lot of it.
In some ways, it's not until book 12. And I mean, book 12 is another hotel. So
that's true.
Yeah.
All right, but let's get into a little bit of the structure of competitive literature. How this is going to work is, for this hour, Jamie is like kind of like our English teacher. Mm-hmm. We're going to start off, me and Julie, giving a synopsis of the book and then maybe the rest of the series. And we, during that synopsis, can call out each other for like lying or saying not something being misleading, accurate. Not being accurate, mm-hmm. Which is
basically
which
we're
is another
be
word for lying. but
she's already beginning.
Yes, this is already kicked off. And then Jamie can question us like a quiz, you know, like trivia about the themes, about our opinions of the book, and we'll have a general discussion of that. And then after that, Jamie's going to declare a winner and say how much of the series or book at hand or whatever she thinks that we have both read. And then we have a couple of other things to wrap it up, but that's the general structure of competitive literature. So, I love it. So let's get into it. Let's do the synopsis.
Right. So the bad beginning. I think we all know where the bad beginning begins. The inciting unfortunate event that starts the unfortunate snowball rolling down the
just steep get to the hill. Plot. Get to the plot. Okay. Did you read any of it? Right now you're just walking in
circles. I'm vamping. I just like wasn't sure if I was supposed to go in. I don't know. This is the first episode. I didn't want to take your anyway. So their parents die in a fire. It's sad.
Okay. It's true.
Yes.
Mr. Poe delivers the news. Mr. Poe coughing all the time hits very differently reading it right now.
Oh, for sure.
It makes me very anxious.
I feel bad for him, you know? And I think that, honestly, as the series goes on, I felt a little progressively more bad for him. Because, like, he apparently knows, he seems to have known a lot more than he had first let on, obviously. Yeah. And yet he's still so bad at his job.
Yeah.
You know?
He knows a lot, but he absolutely does not seem to care at all. So that's...
Yeah.
I don't know.
I hate Mr. Poe. Yeah. I feel like he's a failure of a man.
He's like the system.
Yes. And he's a part of this huge network. And yet he doesn't have any money. Which seems weird to me, too.
Well, he does get promoted to, like, he's in charge of, like, orphan services at the bank that he works.
He gets promoted to orphan. Does kind of feel like...
The bank is maybe a front. I don't know what the...
It feels like Trump cabinet-y in a way.
It's not even...
Where you're like, oh, yeah, someone's in charge of orphans.
Yeah. Generally.
Yeah. It's not even really a bank because... It's called something like just like monetary services. Like money management, you know? So like I feel like he's maybe calling his job a bank to feel better about himself. Like I work at this prestigious bank.
The Baudelaires get kind of as rereading this one, I was like, okay, the Baudelaires, you know, they're going through a really, you know, severe time.
Yes.
To say the least. But they do get a little classist at points where they're like, I don't like Mr. Poe's house. It smells.
I wrote that down. Like, they're okay, like, the sweaters
that's
are itchy.
Evoking a little bit. Yeah, like it's evoking a little parasite for me, and it's like you can't just say Mr. Poe's house smells.
Yeah,
that's not good.
When I read it the first time as a kid or whatever, I was like, oh, the Baudelaires are the heroes. But when I was reading it this time, I was like, where did the Baudelaire fortune come from? Like, I don't know if I trust them until I know. Like,
and I think by the end of the series, we kind of have to believe it came from this cult they ran on an island.
Yes. It's like they were running. Oh, they were running like some weird, like white robe cult on an island.
Yes.
And that's
so. Let's consider someone listening to this hasn't read the books for a second. because if so, much of what we just said is probably just a brick wall.
We really have yet to introduce the three main characters. And
those three.
I'm sorry. I'm talking. Okay.
No, you can talk. You're the head of the class. You can interject at any point. So point B. So begins the bad beginning begins with the fire has burnt down and killed the Baudelaire parents, which, you know, we never see bodies.
No, we don't.
I thought they were going to turn out to be alive throughout most of the series.
There was like sort of a running thing where one of them may be alive for a while, and it doesn't turn out to be the case.
They do it in the Netflix series too, in a way that I found very annoying.
I didn't like that either.
Is it because it's like a lose-lose? Because you're like, oh, if one of their parents is alive, their parent is Will Arnett. Like, I don't know.
And he,
I don't know if I like Patrick Warburton as long
I was about to say the same thing.
Like, he was fun.
Really?
He did a great job. But my one issue with it is it's like Daniel Handler, who is the real identity of Lemony Snicket. Lemony Snicket is his pen name. Was like, this time I want someone buff as hell.
I want a fucking rectangle boy.
Although Jude Law played him in
that is also bad.
That's not right either.
Count Olaf and Lemony Snicket has never been, like, neither of those parts have ever been cast correctly. I'm more angry about Count Olaf because he's supposed to be fucking scary and they keep making him goofy and silly. He's scary.
And
he does in the bad beginning, he still is, like, he does a bunch of scary stuff.
Which we'll get into.
We're about to get into it. So I guess.
So the orphans.
Well, it's interesting. The book kind of is like the Baudelaire children became the Baudelaire orphans, a different species of creature.
Pokemon journey.
They evolved. They transformed.
They've evolved.
In my head, they like were live action, and then they became like the little Victorian drawings that you see in the books. Like when they became orphans, all of a sudden it was like, which I was obsessed with as a kid too. I was really
so good.
Those Brett Hellquist drawings or whatever made me just like, I was like a slut for cross-hatching. I was obsessed.
The orphan aesthetic was really strong.
I thought it really made me view the characters as weird little goopy kids, you know.
What it did for
is that
me
what you guys were saying? Look at the characters.
And that was the intent.
Goopy kids, you know, with
For me, I would see it and I'd go, that's a little droopy sad.
That's a little droopy sad weirdo, you know?
That's a little crazy little goblin.
Speaking of like calling them Victorian, that's what I thought too. Like within the first part of the book, they mention horse-drawn carriages.
And motorcycles in the same sentence.
And cars. And then as you go through it, there are credit cards as well. There's supermarkets.
I think it's supposed to be like out of time. I think
At 100%. Yeah. I mean, I think that if anything, it's like after a large war. Like it's after like something that like reset everything. And the reason I say that is one detail I never picked up on until I reread the first book is as they're going to Mr. Poe's house, right after he tells them what's happened, they pass the what they said used to be the Royal Gardens, but now is a pile of dirt because the Royal Gardens burnt down. What happened?
So they lived in a monarchy at some point.
It's funny that despite that, you never hear them just casually going like, I wonder what happened to like the deposed king or whatever.
The government
that they murdered the king.
But there's a drawing in this book that has a sign that says vote. There really is.
Well, democracy is new in the bad beginning, I guess.
I always wonder at what point did did Daniel Handler and Brett Hellquist start talking to each other and start being like at what point did the illustrations become referential? I feel like in the first book they might just kind of be like whatever.
Well,
he reverse engineers it later.
If you followed like the lore of the book, you could be like, well, Brett Hellquist is like receiving like fragmented letters from Lemony Snicket, so he's just kind of like putting it together. Like there's some inaccuracies in the drawings.
It's like
there's always that hint at like the in the last like illustration of the book, there would always be like a hint as to like what was going to happen in the next book. So like in this one, it's like the little snake.
Yeah.
In the last illustration. So it's like he at least knew that much.
I also wondered about that. Like, did he put the hint in because he'd like, I wonder how far ahead of like manuscript wise he was for each book, or did he put a snake in and then he's like, I guess I have to figure out what to do about like, the snake right. that I.
I think it's kind of like when, you know, like a white author will like write about like a different culture, like from across mm-hmm. the world, and like homogenize it and take mm-hmm. all these different parts of history of it and just smash them together, you right. know, and it's like very disrespectful and like not not knowledgeable of this like, other culture. Cool. But it's like Daniel Handler mm-hmm. did that to like Western Europe. Took multiple parts of history, that's okay. Feel free to do that to your shit, but like that's what he did.
There's like all sorts of weird theories as to like where this takes place and what. I don't know, I've gone in way too deep on it. There's like all sorts of theories, well, and some of them are kind of interesting. Like some of them are like, oh, this takes place in like a different author's fictional universe and he's putting his book inside of like a Vladimir Nabokov like book from Whoa. 50 years ago, which could be true. I don't know.
Well, there's just except for the credit cards.
There's a couple of
the credit cards.
They didn't have the credit cards. It's weird.
All right. I guess we should move on to after the their parents die and they become.
Sorry. Yeah. What happened?
Yeah. After they become, they transform into orphans.
They transform into these
on the beach.
Teenage Mutant Ninja orphans.
Yeah, we have our oldest orphan is now I feel like I'm talking about them like they're creatures. Violet is the oldest and she likes to invent things, which I feel like is by far the most useful skill.
Oh, for sure. I mean, at least I like Klaus, you know, reading. That's great. He's smart. He knows.
But
a
like
lot
Violet
of words.
Could. But, pull yeah. off a lot of the reading stuff that he
that's
off.
True yeah
Violet, if she had
right. and she has too
and she has
I mean there in are... this book Klaus does not come in to save the day
yeah
like she's kinda, the he... one who like figured it out
yeah
like read the law closely which yeah. we'll get to I'm glad Sunny... they gave Sunny oh, something
you well, know? See, here's my thing with Sunny it's like she Sunny's the baby, the youngest,
mm-hmm.
and she bites things is her whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then later in the books, they're like, she gets a little older and they're like, actually, she's getting older. So now her skill is cooking. Mm-hmm. And I was mm-hmm. like, why couldn't it have just been biting? Like, I wish they could just like committed to the bit. And she's like a 6-year-old, like still just biting everything.
Or she could have
been. But then they're like, oh, she uses her teeth as knives, which is, it sounds so gross. Yeah. They're like, oh yeah, Sunny chopped yes. off carrots with her mouth.
Yeah, there's a
like,
lot of
that's nasty.
There's a lot of absolutely nasty shit that like yeah. Sunny does in this book.
She's also kind of an oracle. Like she'll like yes. just scream out some random word and yeah. like communicate. Like,
but like
what she
that's needs. The real power. Yeah, yeah, she knows the future.
But she also like a lot of the like little things she says that are supposed to be like baby gibberish or like little winking references to like mm-hmm. authors and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so again, mm-hmm. it's like that's very oracle-esque. Like she's kind of just divining like one word from the universe.
She
to, like,
knows
express.
Latin.
Yes.
I remember in it's the 10th book. I know these books way too well. In the 10th book, I remember I learned what locks was. Because yes. Sunny prepared some with her mouth.
Yeah. But again, see, I don't buy that, like, because we've been with Sunny, like, presumably most of her life. Like, the other two have lived life right. before this book, so we don't know what they may have learned or not learned. But we're with like Sunny for her old. Developing years, and then she's like, oh, I'll just whip up a lox. Like, I'm a natural at cooking. And I'm like, well, you don't just know lox from nowhere.
Do you remember, there's, like, there's a different book where she knows that the culinary equivalent of horseradish is like
wasabi.
What the wasabi. I was like,
yeah,
she's one.
She has
she's
like this like multicultural like knowledge of
food. And that just goes to show that she is an oracle of some sort. Like, yeah, she's in tune with the greater world. Yeah, she should have just started floating at one point.
Yeah, I think yeah, Sunny is essentially channeling just like information the whole time.
Sunny's existence really does kind of nullify any need for Klaus, because it seems like between her and Violet, they could probably do without Klaus.
I mean, Klaus is there to get the shit beaten out of him.
Yeah, like, Klaus does take a lot.
To, like, be violent Klaus. To one of them.
Klaus. Yeah, because they're like, Klaus. I also loved Klaus, which makes a lot of sense.
I had a huge crush on him in the Jim Carrey movie.
I was really upset that he didn't wear glasses in the Jim Carrey movie, because that's...
Oh, I forgot that.
I mean, I know they didn't do the miserable meal, but that's like a very important part of the miserable meal. Mm-hmm.
They couldn't have.
And they couldn't have. And I was like, what were you going to do if you got the sequel? I guess they could have just hypnotized, because in that book, for the people who don't know, he gets hypnotized in an optometrist's office.
That's one of the worst books, and I stand by that.
Yeah. That book was hard. I think I took a couple breaks in that series when I was growing up, like, where I needed to, like, I got through half a book, and then I needed to, like, take a break from it. And I think the Miserable mm-hmm. Mill and the Vile Village were the ones where I really
had to be
like... Yeah, those are my two. I 100% agree. I don't like the Vile Village. What I like about the Miserable Mill is it's just like a bunch of people realizing like that the 40-hour work week is like bullshit.
Oh, and,
like,
for sure. No, it's like, a good
They need to like unionize,
it's
just, like, basically.
It's terrible.
The union message is strong.
Yeah.
I just... It's not really the most fun. Yeah.
And the Vile Village is tough to get through because it just kind of reaches a level of absurd that's hard to picture.
Yeah. It's the most, I think it's the closest to a horror movie than any of the books. That and maybe the one where they're on the sub. That one is also pretty terrifying.
That one is also tough. Yeah. That one's scary.
The other ones
that's
are
the one where you find out the hook-handed man is like...
Yeah,
that didn't make sense here, to me.
That book falls in like the, there's like kind of three phases of the book where it's like the beginning few, like four or five, the kids are like pretty much painted as innocent hero of the book. And then there's the middle where they like kind of get framed as criminals and they're on the run and it's like the world's against them. And then the like latter half, they're starting to do things that they don't even like know if they agree, like it's the moral gray area like section of the story. So I feel like that whole book falls in that category where they're starting to get really heady on like, are we all good, are we all bad? And they're like, surprise, the hook-handed man, who is truly painted as like just a caricature of like scary
in the first book especially, you're like, oh, he's horrible.
Yeah,
like,
he's so bad, he's like
terrifying. But then later they're like, but wait, he has a stepsister. And you're like, I don't think I care. Like, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyways, sorry.
Yeah. So those are the three orphans. And then they spend, after their parents pass away, they spend some time at Mr. Poe's house because he's the, like, not benefactor, but he's handling their parents' money and all that. And that's where we get that weird, like, classism of, like, they are experiencing a real sadness at that point, but they are also being like, there's not a whole lot of room in this house that we're staying in. Not, like, our mansion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they have to, like, part of this series is them just realizing that poor people are real people.
Oh, yeah. This is a story of radicalization for sure. It's like these like kids who've had everything all of a sudden are like thrust into a very uncaring system.
Yeah.
And are like, oh.
Also, one of the big things that struck me on this read was how quickly they gloss over how the Baudelaire parents wrote their will. Because the way that they wrote their will was like, well, raise our kids in however is most convenient.
Yeah.
It really seems to open them up to being abducted by a count.
Yeah.
Like, especially,
well,
that's another thing where it's like, if you know how the parent story like goes later, you would think that they would have been,
you think they would have been
cautious.
Concerned about this kind of thing happening.
I think maybe they just thought the VFD would take care of it. you know?
Yeah, maybe when they wrote the will, it was like, I guess not pre-schism or whatever within the
collective will take care of our children.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah. They probably were expecting their kids to be taken off into the night at some point anyways, right?
Yes, that's true.
Because that's what that the is VFD what does.
The VFD does. Losses, right?
Yeah.
The VFD
prequel
is this.
Shit.
So, but we're still not even halfway through this synopsis,
no,
but... Well, I can. I'll let's keep going.
All right. So you remember the
wild
VFD
press for the volunteer fire department, a very real entity.
Yeah.
Wild.
That they could just kidnap you at any moment.
Anyway. Yeah. So where were we? Oh, there. So they eventually get sent to their nearest, I guess, most convenient, as per the will of their parents' relative. Which is the terrible antagonist of this series.
Yeah. Well,
who has never been cast.
I'm going to say to be fair for a second. This is me saying to be fair. Okay.
Oh, no. I am ready for this.
To be fair, the will does say nearest relative. And the joke there is that Mr. Poe interprets it as like geographically closest. But they probably meant.
Right.
Like, you know, like an aunt or something.
Yeah.
Not, and yeah.
That is sort of like a lot of what the book's humor and like just mm-hmm. style comes from, too, is mm-hmm. like misinterpreting words that have multiple meanings or like explaining yeah. how words can be used mm-hmm. in different ways. So that
it's a
feels
fun,
relevant.
It's a very funny book. I mean, even to this day, I think yeah. it's a very funny book.
It's funny. I feel like it made me more annoying, too, because I was like, I had this vocab.
I think it let me do pretty well on the SATs, honestly. Like, as I was reading back through this, I was like, oh, most of my vocabulary is just from a
yeah,
series
I think
of unfortunate
it
events.
Reinforced a lot of, like, ideas that I already had but was, like, hoping were true. Like, being sad makes you a better writer.
Yes, yeah.
Or, like, it's a painful, like, kind of, like, self-flagellating experience to write anything. Like,
yeah. My dad died in the middle of all of these coming out, and it really kind of made me wonder, like, what... There's got to be more to this, right? He wasn't right. just an alcoholic who used up his body quickly.
Right, you were there's like, maybe there's a tunnel like under my house.
Yeah. And that was unhealthy. But it was also fun. You know, it was also very fun.
And that's so, the rule is if something is unhealthy, but it's fun, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
You know, I think that rule is, it's kind of a rule when you're a kid in some ways. Like a lot of things that are fun yeah. are fun. I don't know.
Absolutely. No, I agree. Anyway, so where were we? We were... At the Count Olaf's door, I believe.
Yeah, so they're brought to Count Olaf, the geographically nearest relative. And at first they think that they're going to be living in this beautiful house
beautiful.
That's owned by this beautiful, I imagine her as very sexy, judge.
I think, how can you not?
Yeah. Justice Strauss, who's very nice to them.
When they introduce a mother-like character, how can you not immediately go,
Yeah, I just imagine Justice Strauss as looking like Mrs. Incredible. just got that big yeah. dump truck ass.
Just got those proportions.
I think it's okay to sexualize one character in every book. And in this book,
and today
I
it's Justice Strauss. That's a good yeah. rule. That's a really good rule.
But that's not the house they get to stay in, because they think that maybe no. she is Count Olaf's wife. Mm-hmm. But it will be very important.
She's immediately like,
story.
Oh, God,
yeah,
no.
Yeah, no. She's like, I am not Count Olaf's wife. Count Olaf is a bachelor, which is important for the rest of the story. And yeah. his house looks like shit. His yeah. house looks disgusting.
Yeah.
And this is like, I guess, the house that they think is stinky, that it's like maybe justified.
Yeah, yes, yeah, yeah. And yeah. At this point, sure. the yeah. way they describe it, it's like, okay, you're not just like casting an eye over this place and like being like, no.
Yeah. I mean, for right. Olaf, I don't think it's a result of him not having a lot of money. I think it's a result of him not caring. Yes. Like, just like not doing anything to keep up the house. because he doesn't really mm-hmm. care about it, because he has delusions of grandeur, because he's like, well, this, I won't be here for that long.
He's not here to get out of Swiffer. He's not here to get out of a Swiffer.
He's not Elon Musk, you know? He's not like getting all these great ideas, making billions of dollars. He's just trying to scam kids. He's not like a good guy like Elon Musk.
Elon
Musk is so cool.
He's an amazing
I do
guy.
Like that the villain of this series is like an actor too. I feel like that's important.
Elon Musk should play Count Olaf in the next adaptation.
Okay.
He can't and he may not enter this series. I wonder who would be a good Count Olaf. I always imagine like Jeremy Irons' voice when I hear him, but Jeremy Irons is a bad person and also probably too old.
Yeah.
How bad is Jeremy Irons?
He's like, look up, he's just like a notorious asshole who's a really mean person and he doesn't think women should get paid the same amount of dollars.
Bad. He made this weird comment about gay marriage a while back. That was so weird. I wasn't mad at him. Like, if that makes sense. He was like, I don't know if I agree with gay marriage, because then men could marry their fathers and not have to pay a tax on their inheritance.
Why? Like, really? Yeah. He's really concerned about those galaxy brain homophobia.
And it's so weird.
At the end of the day, Jeremy Irons does not hate gay people. He hates loopholes.
Yeah. He's the working man. Specifically man, not woman. Yeah. Specifically man.
He's truly a bad, I don't know. He also played the villain in Lolita, and then if you watch his like press junkets for it, he's like
a little too into it.
I don't see what the big deal is.
Jesus
like it's kind of that. Like he's a bad kind of fella.
Oh no.
But anyways, that's why I think of him when I think of Count Olaf. Also a bad kind of fella.
What about a really tall guy like Nikolai Jokic? That's not his real name. that one basketball player.
That's maybe the second time I've ever heard someone say that name out.
Yeah. It took me a while. I was just like hearing sounds. Like,
I've seen these words written down.
I think actually.
Could be.
Honestly, I think
like casting an athlete as Count Olaf, like that would be really.
That'd be a real choice. Like if you just
you've got like
stunt okay, we're gonna hire a goalie. Yeah.
Yeah. Or you
like
got
stunt like cast an athlete.
Yao Ming is back, and this time he's Count Olaf.
Yao Ming is back doing something different.
Yeah. Yao Ming is back. No basketball.
We need someone tall.
Oh man,
maybe he could. We don't know. Was Yao Ming ever in a movie?
He must have been mentioned in a movie.
I think
kind of like a Yao Ming's IMDb.
Yeah, I think an all athlete cast would be an interesting take.
Yeah,
that would be great.
Yeah,
like some t-ball players play Klaus and
Simone Biles can be, I don't know, Carmelita.
Oh, that's a good part too.
Yeah.
A meaty part. He was in an episode of The Simpsons in 2005.
So he's got enough. The resume.
Yeah,
he's got...
and he was in two episodes of South Park. Yao Ming loves adult animation.
You heard it here first.
Maybe the next one just needs you know who I think would make a good Count Olaf? Ed Asner. He's not tall, but I think he could really be menacing, you know?
Anyway, okay, where were we
so
before we had officially cast Yao Ming?
We've gotten past Justice Strauss.
Yes.
We've defined her mostly in terms of how attracted we are to her.
Yes.
Or at least at some point being, we're there. They're now at Count Olaf's house in earnest, and he opens the door. And it looks like shit on the inside, too. And he promises
he has several very distinct features that get referenced really frequently.
A ton of eyes
in the book. a lot of eyes in the book. He has an eye tattoo, which turns out to have more meaning than that, even. Can you imagine? And then he's got a unibrow, which was helpful for my mom to see a series where having a unibrow was a bad thing, because that was she already was on that train.
All of the evil people are described as looking like disgusting. And when I say disgusting, I mean like they're not disgusting because they're fat or have like appearances that are like celebrated in media. But like I say that they're portrayed as disgusting because they literally say they're disgusting. You know, like the features that are described wouldn't make someone who had them disgusting, but like they're portrayed as if these features are disgusting, you know?
Right.
So they're like saying, oh, if you have warts, you're disgusting. If you're fat, you're disgusting. If you look like Count Olaf,
any body hair.
If you look like a hairless bird, you're or like a not a hairless.
If you have a tattoo. If you have hooks,
right? But those are the feet. Oh, and he's got shiny eyes. They're like really into shining eyes in this book series. So those are the features that will be used to identify him later when he starts getting into costume and trying to pull one over on everybody. But right now he's just
himself. Regular Count Olaf. Tall just guy. Just a guy. But a bad guy, you know? So he welcomes,
not like the other guys.
Like the other guys. He's bad guy. I mean, summer 2021.
Yes. So he wastes no time in starting to be a terrible guardian to the children. I'm trying to remember what his I think he gives them one bed.
He gives them one bed.
That's really small.
He gives them a cardboard box for a refrigerator, you know, that's empty.
Yeah.
To put all their clothes in. Which they then put all of their clothes in, which seems silly to me. Like they should just organize like,
you don't have to go through the motions of it. You don't have to dignify that box.
Like that seems worse. Like, oh, all right, time to dig through an entire box every day and find the clothes that I want.
Yeah, so they have terrible sleeping arrangements. Sunny sleeps in like a lump of curtains or something. He just gives them chores every day, which is not inherently bad, but they're like, he's not home all the time. He makes them chop wood. He makes them cook dinner.
Cook dinner. Like, which is that's the first big, that the night of the dinner is the first big junction point where, because like it's horrible before then. And I mean, when Mr. Poe drops him off, Count Olaf makes reference to that he's going to use the Baudelaire's money to make his house fixed up and cleaned and whatnot. And which Mr. Poe says does not take that as a big enough red flag, but he's just nope, you can't do that. That's not how it works.
He doesn't say you can't do that. He says you can't do that yet because Violet needs to come of age before you can.
You'll be able to do that any day.
If you've manipulated her enough by the time she turs 18, you certainly can use her money, but you're going to have to start doing that.
If you've succeeded in making, like, in the Stockholm syndrome of this, then you'll be good to go.
So, they eat gray oatmeal every morning that Count Olaf just leaves out for them. And we don't know what they eat for the rest of the day, but that's what they eat in the mornings.
There's a lot throughout the book. There's a lot of them just barely eating or eating like whatever scraps they can find, and it's very sad.
Do you think they were on?
They're always eating. They're like described as eating really fast. No.
Do you think their parents had them on keto? Like, so they're kind of like, what's going on here?
Almost definitely.
This VFD thing, like, I don't know what level of, like, control the, like, cultishness, like, exerted over the diets of their members, but, like, who knows?
I think also that they're accepting this poor treatment in large part because they've never been treated poorly by an adult before.
Yeah.
You know? Like, so they're just kind of like, okay, well, when is this changing?
And they also give people a lot of chance. They generally have like a lot of compassion for people. Like they seem to believe the best in people a lot. Like even when they have later guardians that kind of let them down or do don't fulfill their duties as guardians. They never like hate them. They're always kind of like, that was a bad thing to do and they shouldn't have done that. But I understand like why they were too scared to do this or whatever.
Which is, I like how there's like how they describe how often how like the Baudelaires like won't stand up for themselves out of like a fear of being impolite or making someone mad. I remember like that really hitting for me when I was a kid.
Right.
Like, oh yeah, I'm like, I live with an evil count and I want to die, but I want to be rude and say that to this person who might be able to help me.
Right.
Instead, I will just ask them to help me get pasta.
Yes. Like it's, I felt that throughout my childhood at different points for different reasons where like you can't quite say what's happening, you know, like with bullying or some or like whatever is going on in your life. You can't quite say what's happening, but you can just like with your eyes and like with whatever else requests you have, whatever other requests you have, really get across like, I need your love, random adult. Like I need your support. Yeah. Please.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to read a book.
Yeah.
You're just like,
you know.
Yeah. They're like, we're three.
I'm hearing book. I'm seeing. Adoption.
And these three kids are absolutely horny for libraries.
Yes. They. Although, I also, a very non-horny book.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
Like,
besides the undeniable allure of Justice Strauss.
Yes. Yeah. Besides the undeniable.
And her big dump truck
Just because like, there's no really, like, romance, you know? I think, like, later on, that kind of gets into it in some.
Yeah.
In some
and they really don't even.
Unconventional ways, but.
Yeah. And they don't get into it too much then either because. It feels like even the book knows, like, they have bigger things to deal with.
Yes.
Like, there's a couple instances of it, but it never becomes center stage. And it's if you're not looking for it, you almost kind of read right past it. Which is,
and the moments that it actually happens are, like, so weird.
Yeah.
Like, in the last book when Olaf, like, kisses Kit? Yeah. They're just weird.
Never was a huge fan of that.
That was weird.
You're just like,
was he the father?
I felt like they were trying
baby?
To do like a Snape thing.
That whole book is like
no,
a trip.
He wasn't. It was like the dead hotelier guy.
Oh, yeah.
Dewey, what's his name?
The guy that they accidentally kill with a harpoon.
Yeah. Right. They harpoon him and then they're like, wow, life is morally ambiguous, isn't it? And it's like, you did just harpoon a man to death.
So yeah.
That's one way to look at it.
Yeah.
So they're doing all these chores. Count Olaf one day in one of his notes demands that they cook dinner
for his theater troupe.
For his theater troupe, doesn't say what to cook, so they don't know what to cook. They go over to the justice's house and they're like, "Hey, we need a cookbook because we have to cook a meal for like 13 people."
And she's like, "That seems 13. Wrong."
But yeah, she's like. That's so, I don't know if I agree with you children having to cook for such a large group of adults, but that doesn't
But I don't
want to
say anything
to
mean, like,
yeah.
Everyone's like, I don't want to rock the boat.
Like, what kind of cases is she judging that she,
well, she also,
this would not
is a
be a red flag.
Yes, she's like a Supreme Court justice. She's like on the high court, which seems
Which maybe had
in
a hand.
Society, the way they like draw her, you're like, oh, she's like really powerful.
Yeah.
How could she not?
She maybe had a hand in like determining the punishment for the king
She was a revolutionary.
I have it on good authority that she voted against Roe v. Wade. She wanted to overturn.
Yeah, I want to see her voting record. I want to see.
She's a problematic face.
I want to see what her.
Because she did try to take abortion rights.
What is Justice Strauss's NRA report card?
Yeah.
That's what I want to know. Feels like an A.
She's got what? They don't talk about. They never talk about Justice Strauss's gun room. Yeah. But that's another room in her house.
And they don't talk about all of the gender critical books in her library.
Yes. And they don't talk about the turf wing of her personal library.
But she's hot, you know. So she's hot.
And she does take them to the supermarket and get them ingredients for pasta puttanesca.
She takes them to like three places, like a street vendor,
a market, and then
the supermarket.
Yeah.
It's almost like more work than it would have been to just ask them if they are comfortable living.
I feel like everyone though remembers Pasta Putanesca from this book. Like we all,
and it grossed me out. I had it for the first time kind of recently, and I was like, "Oh, that's great! It's tasty." But like,
is it good?
It is good. I mean, it's great. It's a great simple pasta.
Sounds great. Maybe I should have made it in prep for this.
But. Oh, that would have been great.
And just and was like slurping it.
You could have sent us some boxes of it.
Yeah, I like literally a box you unfold it, and it's just like.
It does sound like a very wet. Yeah. Every time they describe make it, you're like, this is a very wet.
Yeah, just the whole time.
If you're expecting, not to defend Count Olaf in any way, but I always do think it's the line of dialogue where he says that he's going to go get so drunk he's going to forget he wanted roast beef is a very funny
one to me. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I honestly relate to that. Like,
yeah, it's like, who am I?
If I'm like picturing a food all day and then like it's either gone or like I don't get to have that food, I Hulk out, man.
Yeah. So,
but I don't hit children.
Yes, which and is, that's where Count Olaf does.
That's the thing. And that's
the line between Count Olaf and me.
Well, he also does like the way that builds too is so
scary.
Like, yeah, because at first he like picks Sunny up and scares the two older siblings. And then he like says, I mean, a lot of different characters say like creepy stuff to Violet.
Yes.
And they're like,
yes.
Oh, you're so beautiful. Yes. And then it was like Klaus is like the last kid that like every kid gets some form of abuse at this dinner. It's like, it's so scary.
Yeah, it's very scary. And so basically, yeah, those two things happen that we described. And then Klaus is kind of like, you have to stop saying these things. And then Olaf just nails him across the face. And it's very scary and upsetting. And it's kind of that moment where you're like, oh, this is like, they have to get out now. I think, and that's the moment for them too, where they go from like, we'll just be polite, we'll see how it goes. And they're like, I think we actually have to get out of here. I think this is like not safe for us. Especially Sunny, but certainly not for us either.
Yeah. And when you're a kid and you get hit, it's like, I didn't know this was on the board, you know? Yeah, I didn't know this was a card you could play.
It's so effective.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the threat level increases to them at that point, and then they realize they have to kind of get out, and that he is an evil person who just wants them for their money. And
they consider homelessness. They consider going on the streets, and and they're kind of immediately like, that sounds gross. Like they're kind of they don't even consider like they think it's not even a possibility really for them, which is like you know, probably another commentary on like they would rather be in this like. Crazy man,
this terrible house. Situation than unhoused.
Right.
But you know, we forgive them because they're children.
Yes, we forgive them because they're children.
And I'm like, I guess this is a city that every building seems to burn down at some point too.
Yeah,
like, I don't know where
are people living. You know,
so yeah, they realize that it's time to get out, but simultaneously. Or I guess they talk to Mr. Poe, but help, as per usual.
They go to Mr. Poe, and he just thinks they're complaining about chores, because every time they shout at him, or, like, they say it at first, and they get to shouting, that Olaf, like, struck Klaus, a phone rings. One of his, or he coughs. And so he's like, what are you saying? Chores? I'm sorry your parents didn't make you do chores.
Yeah. Like, internally.
I'm like, wow.
Internally, Mr. Poe is like,
really,
clap
your
back.
House smells comment came back to roost. Yeah.
Mr. Poe is clapping back that whole scene, basically. Yeah. Or at least that's his perception of it. Meanwhile, the kids are like, there's physical aggression happening.
Yeah.
And he's like, sorry, I can't hear you over all my phones. Yeah.
He's like, some of us have phones to deal with.
And every
some
time
of us don't have fortunes, and so we have to answer phones. Yeah. Okay?
Some of us have several phones at a bank.
And whenever he picks up the phone, all he says is like 6-7-9-9-5. Like,
I thought that was so funny as a kid. It's always like yes, 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 no, goodbye. Oh, it made me laugh. But yeah, so basically they leave that situation with no help. And at that moment, I think, is when Count Olaf informs them that they'll be in a play.
Yes. The next morning, they see that Olaf is actually down there.
Oh, yes. And like, he's got like breakfast. He's got slightly less gray oatmeal for them with one little raspberry on top.
And
In spite of myself, I read that and I was like, I want some.
You load up any bowl of any sort of mush with enough berries, it's going to be good.
That becomes a premium bowl.
Yeah. So he eats a little bit to show them it's not poison. And he's like, see, I'm being very nice to you, my children.
And then he says they're going to be in a play. And they're like, we don't really want to be in a play. And then he's like, I'm your father and I own you and control you and you will be in this play.
But they can also sense that this might be a scheme. Like, they feel like something's up and he's too excited about it because they start to try and figure out what he's up to.
Yeah, because the play, I mean, he explains that Violet will be playing a bride and her only line will be, I do. And then Klaus and Sonny will be in the audience. And they're immediately like, well, come on, something's up. And so they
turn to the magic of reading.
Yes, they go to Justice Strauss Library. They read on Inheritance Law, and the justice is like, oh, that's weird.
She's like, you little rascals.
Another.
But she's just like, they keep ignoring my turf section and my gun room. So I guess I'll just be happy that they're happy.
Yeah. And
that's like another like plot hole here is like they seem to spend a lot of time with Justice Strauss, but I don't know. It's like I like the theme of this book that like adults, even when they're listening to kids, are not really listening to them. Like that's really cool. But even on a basic level, I'm like, has Justice Strauss asked them absolutely nothing about themselves? Because if anyone describes the situation,
right,
it sounds very suspicious. Like, it sounds weird as hell. And also, does she not know that one of the wealthiest families in town's mansion burned down?
Right. Yes,
there seems to be a lot of
like Count Olaf lives fairly close to the Baudelaire. So there's like, she has to know of them, I believe.
Well, he's on the other side of town. And, you know, I don't know anything that's happening on the other side of my town. But
A mansion burns down on the west side. I'm none the wiser.
Yeah, the greater.
I have no idea.
The greater Glendale area is a mystery to me. Yeah. So, fair point. But, yeah, so they start reading up on inheritance law, trying to figure out just what he could possibly be up to that could cause him to inherit the fortune earlier than when Violet comes of age. And how that might be related to the play that they're being asked to perform. And Klaus stays up all night reading, I think.
Well, everyone else sleeps except for Klaus while he reads up on the entire book and finds a very good piece of info to have.
Oh, yeah. And then he confronts Count Olaf with this information that in whatever city they're in,
it says the wording is weird. It's like, in this community, Meredith.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like really written just like, hey Klaus, in this community the only thing you have to do to marry someone legally is to say I do, I think, in front of witness or in front of a judge.
Yeah, and sign a
paper. And then sign a paper that says you're married, a certificate in your own hand. Very important.
Yes. And
very important.
Very important. And it's okay if you're 14, like Violet. It's okay if you're a 14-year-old.
Yeah.
Because your dad can just say, hey, you can get married, and you can also get married to me, your dad. Apparently. Yeah. They never hit on that.
Is this, this is pretty much what Jeremy Irons feared would come to pass. Yes! Yeah. Except just it's the non-gay version.
Yeah, we're sorry about anything bad we said about you, Jeremy Irons.
You were right. Yeah. Assuming, yeah. It would actually be a really bad situation.
Yeah, this actually sounds super bad. So they realize Jeremy Irons was right. The book is by Jeremy Irons that they read. They realize that he's right and that Count Olaf is trying to legit marry Violet during this play. Mm-hmm. And then through doing that, he will gain control of the fortune.
And Klaus thinks this is like, he's won. He thinks he's defeated.
Yeah, I don't know why. He gets real confident. He puts on his like sunglasses and goes downstairs and he's like, Count Olaf, I figured it out. And Count Olaf's like, okay.
Count Olaf literally laughs at him.
He's like, okay, I'm going to put your baby sister in a cage and hang her over a window ledge. Yes. And what will you do then? Be in my play?
Yeah,
and
on Klaus this high like, tower. Off great of this high tower.
Yeah.
How did no one see that? How did no one see that? I know she couldn't make sound, but how did no one see that?
Right. And she's got the craziest teeth in the dang business. So you'd think like a little tape, she could be like,
I can't take bars.
Yeah. She uses her teeth as a sword later in the series.
I forgot about when she uses it as a sword. Yeah.
Yeah. And I believe she climbs an elevator shaft with her teeth as well.
Oh, yes. She definitely does that.
It is way better when she is just biting when you put it
right down. Like it's so much better than later when she's like, I added a little cinnamon to the hot chocolate, what do you think?
Right. You climbed an elevator shaft with your mouth, bring that back.
Yeah, it's like you're kind of on a like a downward, like you're de-escalating here.
Yeah. We love you for who you are, Sunny, and now you're trying to be someone else.
Yeah.
Get back to your roots, baby girl.
Yeah. But so that's his answer to that, which is like a pretty decisive answer, is like, yeah, that's a good point. You can kill us and we can't do anything about that. So they don't really know what to do at that point. They're like, I think we have to just go through with the play because we don't want Sunny to die. But they're kind of like, all right, maybe we can break her out.
Violet makes this like cuts her hands up through making this grappling hook that she has to like take a curtain rod and bend it every which way.
They really always very detailed describe how she makes the invention and how it works, and my eyes just kind of glaze over and I'm like, yeah, okay,
yeah. Sure.
So she does it.
She makes this grappling hook and gets really fucked up while using it.
Yeah. She rips open her shoulder. She climbs up this tower. She gets to Sunny. Mm-hmm. But then it turns out the thing that her grappling hook was able to get traction on was the hook of the hook-handed man,
I think. The hook-handed man is so she's
like, which is like the hook-handed man is just there. Yes. Like, yeah, like standing there waiting for
like,
her to climb.
You know, there's a moment where the grappling hook like hooks on him and he's like, ooh, okay, I could like... I could play my hand now, or I could do could have like a dramatic reveal where she like climbs up and then she sees me at the top. And he like, as he's saying it to himself, he's like, oh, that's the more cinematic option.
For sure.
And he's like,
he's an actor. He's got to go for the most dramatic option.
So true.
So they have her trapped in the tower with Sunny now. And then they grab Klaus because they're like, well, let's put them all together. Right. And they also, that's where they put the nuptial law book.
So they're now like, let's trap them with the only information they could possibly need to solve this. Okay. That's my voice for all of the henchmen.
Yeah. Boldle ass. These orphans, they aren't really kids, you know. They're orphans, you know. Treat them however you want.
I don't care what happens in
all
this
henchmen
room.
Are newsies. That's just a rule.
That's newsies, where they get their start. That's newsy is like level one of henchmen. And then,
Absolutely. So at this point, it seems like all is lost and the play is starting to happen, and they spend a lot of time talking about how Justice Strauss, who is recruited to be in this play because she's a judge and she's just like stars in her eyes. They talk a lot about how like Justice Strauss can't be reached because she is so like struck by the magic that is live theater that she like can't
it's
even
really
hear.
Sad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's like, I'm going to be a hit. I'm going to be in the pictures.
I'm going to be a star.
Yeah. I'm going to be in the movies. And
they don't even get to see the first two parts of the play. You're just thrown in. It's act three is about to begin. Yeah. So apparently Violet, the bride, this play that's about a wedding, has not had the bride in it until like the very last scene.
Yeah, I mean, it's written by Al Funkhut, which is just an anagram of Count Olaf. So I'm assuming he wrote it in like a day. And yeah. It's...
I've been there. I wrote an allegorical short one-act play about gay marriage when I was in 10th grade called There Are Those That Are Red and Those That Are Blue.
Oh my God. That's the most cinematic name for anything I've ever heard. That could mean anything. Yeah. I love it.
But yeah, so we've all been there. We've all written something in like a day.
Yeah.
And this, yeah. So we get to the climax of the play and the book pretty much, which is Violet's marriage scene. And I still find it incredible that the climax of this whole book is her realizing that she's right-handed, basically.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's mentioned before that she's right-handed.
They mention it a lot. They do it at the beach. Yeah. They do it a lot. They're like, use it. It gets to be, I don't think I noticed when I was reading it the first time, but reading it this time, it was like, and she sat down and like put her head in her right hand, which was the hand she used to write with, and which was the hand that's most prominent for her.
She was sad, like it's only really... a right-handed woman could be.
Yeah, right.
Like Violet felt the pain of losing her parents squarely in her right hand that morning. Yeah. Probably because it was her dominant hand. Next chapter.
Yeah. So, yeah. So what leads up to that is she says, I do. They let Sunny go. And then Count Olaf, instead of just like
just like
this
going
happen,
home, signing goes, the papers.
Aha, the play is over because now I have the fortune. Do you see what I've done here?
And the audience is like, what?
The audience is like booing and like, oh, this is gross. And he's like, aha, this is all legal. And I've done it before your eyes. He's got a very libertarian streak to him.
Count Olaf's greatest downfall is being a consummate showman.
Yeah, it's really. He can't.
Fucks him over at every turn. He could just not announce his crimes, but he can't help himself. Yeah. He loves to announce his crimes.
He needs everyone to know that he thought of this brilliant plan. And everyone immediately is like, oh, let's call somebody. and then Violet just kind of is like, actually, it's not legal.
Yeah.
Because I used my
and then it's like, well, did cameras exist? Because we need receipts.
Yeah.
On
I know. She's like, I didn't sign it. Well, yeah, she's like, I didn't sign it in my own hand as the law dictates. I signed it in my non-dominant hand. And everyone's kind of like, I think Count Olaf is like, well, you can't prove that. And she's like, I'm happy to sign my name with both hands. They like really go through and like fill the plot holes, and she's just calmly to the crowd and to Mr. Poe and like the justice
takes a second and then she's like, yeah, makes sense. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone kind of nods and agrees. They're all like, this makes sense. And then Count Olaf's like, well, then I guess that for me it's my turn to turn off the lights and run away. Yeah. Which is what he does.
I also just, I don't know why I always think it's funny that Mr. Poe comes to the play. I don't know why he would.
He always shows
Everyone
up.
Everyone in this community loves local theater. But he's
always weird. In the places you don't want him to be. And he's never in the places you need him to be. That Mr. Poe. Wah, wah.
Makes you think.
It makes you think. So basically, Count Olaf is like, damn it. It was my hubris that brought me here. And then the lights turn off and all of his friends run away. But he like whispers in Violet's ear really quick, like, I'm going to kill you, you pretty little bird, or something like that. Yeah. Something really, it's like equally like threatening, but also like has that weird undertone of like, for some reason, mentioning that she's pretty again.
Yeah. I mean, one disappointing thing is it's like, can't a guy be creepy and evil and abusive to kids and also not a sex pervert for once?
Right?
I guess not. You know?
I want my villains clean.
I might hit kids, but I don't want to freaking molest them, all right?
This is why we can't have nice things. I'm always saying that to people. This is why we can't have nice things.
We're getting ready for our Newsies audition. We're really excited about it.
Yeah, so that's kind of like that's the villain defeated moment, which is, as Lemony Snicket promises, it's not quite a happy ending because he gets away.
He gets away, and Justice Strauss, who is like, hey, come live with me. I love you guys. Let's have a big, happy family together.
Yeah, she's like, oh, no, wait, actually, the law, that's not the law.
Well, that's Mr. Poe's like, hey, sorry.
The will dictates says otherwise.
It's, you know, closest family member.
Yeah.
So
we're going to take them to place.
Justice Strauss gets off easy. Because so many other characters who try to actually take care of them just end up murdered.
Yes.
You know? So, they walk into
bandsaws or, what else happens to them? They get eaten by leeches.
Eaten by leeches or eaten by
a
snake.
They get harpooned.
And then there's just some that just are like, oh, we never cared about you. You can run along.
Yeah. They do a pretty good job of saying that sometimes those people who don't really do anything are almost as evil.
Sure.
These kind of performative there's a lot of performative allies in these books.
You need to be you can't just say you're an ally to orphans. You need to be an ally to orphans, you know?
Right.
We need to see it in your actions.
Right. Jerome.
Yes, yeah, as my squalor. I think he's the worst of all.
Yeah.
Because he just shrugged. He's like, oh my God. I can't believe I didn't believe you about all that stuff. That super sucks. Bye.
So that brings us to the end of the book.
The end of the beginning.
And I think now, Jamie, is the moment wherein you can ask us any questions you want. Thematic questions, trivia questions, whatever you want.
Does it have to just be about the first book?
It can be whatever questions you want.
Okay. I'm going to ask mostly questions that whatever is closest to my personal opinion will be the right answer. But I have a couple of I was brainstorming as I was reading. Mm-hmm. Okay. First, I have a multiple choice question.
Ooh.
Who gave me my copy of The Bad Beginning? There's three options. A, my mom from the Scholastic Book Fair. Ooh. B, I borrowed it from Tammy. C, my dad at the recommendation of his high school girlfriend who he was still in love with.
Whoa.
Ooh, I don't think it was Jill.
Oh, Tammy?
Jill is Jamie's mom.
Grace and my mother.
I was like, that's not a name that I heard.
I'm so sorry. I might have an edge in this competition because Jamie is one of my best friends and is officiating my wedding. Let's put that aside.
I came here to play.
So I don't believe Jill would do that. I think that Tammy, that's funny, but I think that's just there to be funny.
That's a funny little joke.
I'm going to go with C. I think it's from your dad. And now I'll allow you to give your answer.
Jill. Are we not allowed to pick the same one?
You can pick the same answer.
I shouldn't have revealed all of that information.
Well, I've been thinking about it separately with my own reasons, but I'm also going to say C.
Okay, you are both correct.
That is wild. That is
my
wild.
Dad gave me this book Christmas 2002 with the inscription that is it's still like at my childhood house. God. But yeah, with the inscription saying that his friend Tula had recommended it. And then with the wisdom of adulthood, I know who Tula is. And that was not very nice to my mom to write in a book.
Oh, wow. A little unfortunate
did
event
your
of your own.
Dad and Tula end up together?
No. No, they just messaged on Facebook for 4 years and then never contacted each other again, which I feel like is like, that's, I don't know, parents will just do that sometimes. They'll reconnect on Facebook and then form a new toxic relationship and then be like, oh, yeah. I'm done with that.
Absolutely.
So, okay, you're both tied so far. Okay.
I worked really hard for that one.
This is more of an adaptation question. This is okay. So which performer has been in both adaptations of A Series of Unfortunate Events? There's only one person. I can come up with multiple choice.
You don't gosh, I
wait, I think
one.
I have a guess maybe, but I'm trying to remember her name.
I haven't seen the full TV show, but I'm wondering if it's the woman who plays
Justice Strauss.
Oh, who plays Justice Strauss?
I'm trying to remember. It's the pops. She's the mom and pop star. She's in like a lot of different movies. She that plays Justice Strauss in the original movie.
I'm gonna call it here. Grace, you're correct.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
It's Catherine O'Hara. Catherine O'Hara is in
yes.
Her. Oh,
yes.
Oh, man.
She's Justice Strauss in the 2004
she's
movie. And then she plays.
I was so she was
she
yeah. plays
she
wasn't
the
optometrist.
Mom and pop star. But that was who I was mm-hmm. thinking of. Yeah,
that's so funny because I thought of Catherine O'Hara and then I was like, probably not. Or I would have known that.
Couldn't be.
I did not realize that she played Justice Strauss. That's so bizarre.
It's weird. And then that part has been played well twice because it was Catherine O'Hara the first time and Joan Cusack the second.
Yes.
Yeah. And I feel like they're kind of
Joan
like.
Joan Cusack is the mom and pop star.
That was a really.
Yes. Yes. Catherine O'Hara and Joan Cusack feel like a different flavors of the same person.
Yeah. That's
and
incredible.
I like them both.
All right. Well, I'm okay with
Grace.
Getting that wrong.
Point for Grace. Grace has got the
you've heard
right
a point
now.
Break. Here's
okay, this is who has the better answer question.
Oh no.
So they mention in the first book that Count Olaf is up in his tower all day long. What is he doing in that tower all day? All answers will be considered by me.
I'll let you take this one first, Julie.
Thanks for that. I guess, like, I feel like he's writing, like, sort of self-masturbatory fan fiction, maybe, about what's to come in his life. That didn't get much of a response, so I'm going to assume that wasn't... that's not going to win. But he seems to be that kind of... Well, he's, like, Al Funkoot right in the play. Like, I feel like he's producing a lot of journals mm-hmm. and diaries and, like, what I want when I grow up, except he is perpetually in that state of mind. So he's writing like, dear diary, like, this is what I hope happens today. And then just kind of imagining these like elaborate scenes between him and Violet and Klaus and Sunny and everyone he interacts with and just planning out his evilness.
He's manifesting in the tower.
Yeah, he's manifesting in the tower. Mm-hmm. He's not cleaning. That's for sure, ladies.
I think he's got a sad backstory. Also, like
this is gonna be good. I already
died. When he was young, he's Batmaning it. That tower is his bat game, and he's just like Batman's house would look like shit if he didn't have a butler. So Count Olaf doesn't have a butler, and that's why
that's
it looks
point.
Like shit. He thinks he's mm-hmm. he thinks in his heart of hearts that he's a hero because he thinks. What's good in the world would be him having a lot of money, like him going back to the status that his parents yeah. had, right? So he's mm-hmm. looking out
his
on
parents
the city.
Apparently...
Yeah, I mean they were murdered. Weren't they murdered by Kit?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, yeah.
Weren't
yeah.
they murdered
yeah,
by Kit
by like a
or some
by like a dart?
Yeah, and
Oh yeah, they have like all those opera darts. Yeah, and many many adults died by opera darts.
So I think he's up in there, but I don't think he's like writing. Generally speaking, I think that he's like
that's
plotting,
fine.
but all in his head, and he's just looking around at from his tower at the city and thinking about like how it will all be his one day, and he will rise back in prominence.
To be
he's
fair,
viewing himself as this hero.
When I say writing, it's like very like he doesn't know the details.
Julie,
you've
given your answer.
No. I'm just being more specific.
This is just like the multiple choice. I give my answer, and then you're changing yours.
This is not just like the multiple choice answer, because we were given choices to choose from there, and in this case. We had to make up an answer, and you said, Julie, you go immediately. You go first.
That was me being kind. That was me recognizing that I have a tendency to speak first. And
God,
letting
Grace
you
is just crushing me. Grace is crushing
so,
me.
So, yeah, I think he was Batmaning it. I think he's like, what if Batman did not care about anybody else and didn't have a butler? That's your count all office.
I mean, that's okay. A great answer.
But before I reveal who won this round, I would like to say neither of those answers were as gross as I expected them to be.
I was going to say masturbate.
I intentionally said self-masturbatory fiction.
I would like to say Batmaning it includes masturbation.
we're both arguing who implied masturbation heavier.
Every time I read the description of the tower, I feel like I project or I'm waiting for like some like sneaky mention of Dirty Rags.
Yes.
And they never show up. I don't think they ever materialize, but I'm like, he's for sure. Okay. So you're both wrong because he was jacking ass committing up there. But I'll give this round to Grace. I have two more questions and these are worth 2 points.
Wow.
So it's three to one.
My own point.
It's three to one. But this it's could really it's anyone's game.
This is double Jeopardy.
This is double Jeopardy. Okay.
R.I.P. Trebek.
Here's my next question. My next question is, which of their guardians would you most want to have intercourse with and why? And I'll choose whatever answer is more pleasing to me.
Probably Uncle Monty, right? Like, that guy
that's a good answer.
Has a snake, I'm going to guess, in the trousers. And also, he just, I mean, aside from that joke, he seems like a nice guy. He has really cool hair. In the book illustration, and I don't know, he seems like one of the most with it guardians that they have, which appeals to me, like, mm-hmm. He's going to take care of you. And
he wants to bring you to Peru.
He wants to take you on trips. He's not condescending. He's like ready to share. He wants to give and receive information. So a lot of these are like hints to me that he would make a considerate lover.
I love
that.
His name is Montgomery Montgomery. So if you're like screaming his full name, it's just like Montgomery Montgomery.
I'm going to
coming and saying his name. That sounds fun.
I'm going to pull a Julie here and say that.
What does that mean? What are we establishing that means?
It's got to be Monty. There's really, there's just really no other guardian that's both kind, alive, and sexy. Especially if he knew how to use snakes as like bondage ropes. Like who?
Yes.
He's the only one in the world I would trust. You know. Like,
yeah.
for that, and I think it could be really fun.
Yeah, a lot of the other guardians, too, have, like, a lot of, like, direct culpability in what happens to the Baudelaires and, like, Monty doesn't quite approach that as much as the other ones. And so it's like, it feels a little better.
He doesn't. I mean, he lets Count Olaf like into his home and whatnot. But beyond that, like, that's just him being a nice person.
He dies really quick, like, before he can really get into it. So.
Yeah. And I think that, like, Monty has a lot of range, like, sexually. Like, you could, I think he'd be a fun guy for a one-night stand. But if it turned into more, like, that's like, great, you know?
He could become a long-term.
He's probably a good cuddler.
Although he'll fall for anyone with... It is never, I can never get past the cognitive dissonance of him not realizing that it's just his worst enemy with a fake Italian accent.
Yeah. So he maybe has a cartoonish understanding of Italians is his one weakness.
Yeah. And that's not cool, you know?
That's not right. And we need to talk about it.
Did you have a different guardian in mind to kill or marry? No, fuck? I said all the other ones first. Oops. To fuck.
I think you're both correct. Cool. It is Uncle Monty, in spite of the fact that he doesn't understand what his enemies look like. He doesn't know what a fake Italian accent sounds like. He is always played by a hot person. He's nice. He wants to take you to movies and on trips. And, you know, really his greatest downfall is that he's too trusting. And he is murdered by his number one enemy within days. But you're both right, which means that Grace has found a way to game this so that it would be...
I was really hoping you would recognize that I brought up the idea.
Let's actually, you know what? Let's say, because I think Grace is playing very strategically, that Grace, for this 2-point question, Julie, you'll get 2 points. Grace, you'll get 1 point.
But the multiple choice.
All right.
I guess that is kind of a bad precedent.
Yeah, no, but you could do what you want. I'll still win.
I'm so stressed. Okay.
It's okay. I will take 1 point. That's fine. I'll take 1 point.
Okay.
Complicated. Okay. We both said the same person. And I do feel that Grace had good, like, add-ons, like, about the bondage. Like,
the bondage was actually an important part of what
I feel. So I feel like we both had...
Get the snakes involved.
We had different ideas of what makes him a good lover, so... We should share the points.
Okay. So we're going to split the points, which means we are in the same place we were at the last question. So the last question is a little complicated, but I have faith that you will both come through. Okay. So Jim Carrey played Count Olaf in 2004. If you were to guess, what does Jim Carrey think that he has in common with Count Olaf? All answers will be considered.
So this is an answer. This is based off of an answer he's actually given about.
There's no real. He was never asked, what do you have in common? This is based off of what I think he might think that has in common.
I think he and Olaf both think they make art that speaks truth to power. And maybe Jim Carrey wouldn't be like cool with the way Olaf does it, but that might be his like actors in Olaf does.
You know, the thing about this is that Jim Carrey 2004 and Jim Carrey 2020 would have very different
answers. That's a great point.
You know, I really think.
Yeah, like, I might be talking more about current.
Yeah, I think current Jim Carrey would say that. But in my mind, wacky Jim Carrey. Jim Carrey 2004.
Right.
And this wouldn't be an interview question, right? I'm thinking of like someone asking like, him this in conversation.
Really internally, like what is he think?
He'd be like, well, we both aren't circumcised. You know? I think that's what he would say. They both got dangly little skin. Gross.
Okay, Grace wins. Grace wins the question.
And the worst part is I can't argue with this.
One asked the question. Yep, that was the right answer. And I didn't even know what the right answer was.
And we found it. We found the right answer, and I can't even argue that.
I don't care what Neil Patrick Harris thinks he has in common with Count Olaf, because Count Olaf shouldn't sing. He just shouldn't sing. I didn't want
I
it.
Agree with that. Neil Patrick Harris, just go take another family Halloween photo.
Go ask your followers for thousands of dollars in gifts. You miser.
I'm sick of being frustrated by Neil Patrick Harris's performance in Netflix's A Series of Unfortunate Events and only being met with the answer that people liked him in Gone Girl. That's not a satisfactory answer.
See, this is why I didn't watch Gone Girl.
Yeah, this is every time.
It is very jarring when he's suddenly there. It's like on par with Bob Odenkirk suddenly being in Little Women, where you're like, wait a second.
Or like Michael C. Hall at the end.
Wait, does Neil Patrick Harris come like appear in Gone Girl and just go like, oh,
my little Women.
Gone Girl.
My little Gone Girl. My little Gone Girl. Neil Patrick Harris pops his head out and he says, this girl is gone. This girl's gone, honey. No. He just goes away.
Okay, well now I had forgotten about that. So
That's a critical. That's something critical to consider.
So Grace,
those are my questions. Grace, you did win. You came through with the Jim Carrey. I think that's actually, we can consider that canon. Yeah. Pretty safely.
Yeah, it's like it's so true that I can't stop thinking about it.
We gotta put it on the wiki.
Even I feel like it would be. I'm very tempted to test this. If you went to the Wikipedia page for Count Olaf, which I'm sure exists, mm-hmm. like a character Wikipedia page, you could probably pretty easily change it to,
yeah.
to Count Olaf is uncircumcised.
The last. Count Olaf, spoiler alert, Count Olaf dies like on this random island.
That's the last thing you find out about him, because Klaus has to change his clothes into a black suit, obviously, before they bury him. And as he's doing it, he sees his dick. He's like, oh, uncircumcised. Uncircumcised. Uncircumcised in this case means a penis that has not had the foreskin joy.
Klaus just goes up to his sister's like, okay, this is neither good news nor bad news. Yeah. This is just news.
This is a chef's salad of news.
Finally, the last piece of the puzzle in the VFD.
That was actually book 14. Yeah. For big fans of the book.
Just the little...
So we have a section about the author in a second, but before we get to that, how much of the series do you think we respectively read in or reread in preparation for this?
Reread, okay.
Like in prep for this.
That's a good question. Because it's clear you have both read the whole series at some point. I will guess that you both have definitely read the whole first one, and you were both really quick to be like Monty. So I'll say also the second one. I would guess you read between 1.5 and 2.5 books.
Who would you guess, me?
It doesn't seem like one of you is less knowledgeable than the other. Like, it seems like you both... Oh, no. Am I like really, really...
No, angry? I'm just realizing I spent a lot of time doing something I didn't need to.
I'll reveal.
Wait, Julie, did you read... Okay, I was saying, Grace, I'm going to say you read the first 2.5, and Julie, you just tipped your hand, and I'm going to guess you read 12.
Yeah, I read all of them.
You read all of them? Wow.
I read the first one.
It didn't
one.
Help me at all.
I read the first one only, and I read it today.
I reread the first one today, and it's such a fast read. It's like kind of shocking. Wait, Julie, that's so...
For what purpose? No purpose.
I only reread the first one, but now I want to read all of them again, because it's kind of... Now that I know at what points they kind of fall apart and I've become less precious about them with age, I'm just like, I kind of want to know like where it falls apart.
It's interesting. The Hostel Hospital is very interesting.
That's a terrifying.
The Hostel Hospital is a great one. Yeah, yeah. The whole like cranioectomy sequence is terrifying.
And they save Violet from having her head cut open by like exploiting the hospital's love of paperwork over care.
That's another good like societal commentary. One.
Yeah,
I really. Which one is both of your favorites out of the series?
I think probably the Ersatz elevator, because that one is weird and scary and kind of like that's one of the first ones that feels like spy-y, you know?
Yeah.
I really like that one. Yeah.
I think the hospital for me was the one they had those people that go around and like sing to all the patients and they're like,
yes. Oh, yeah. The like volunteers fighting disease.
Yeah. 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 So it's still got a lot of like the funny stuff that you want. I just always like it's spooky. Like that one feels a little scarier because they're like literally threatening to cut her head open.
Yeah, that was Count Olaf really. And I think that's like Count Olaf's last disguise book, too.
I
like
think so, too. One.
And then he just kind of gives up.
Yeah.
Those two are also two. And then I really like the Slippery Slope, too.
Yeah.
I like that one because it's one of the only horny ones where they kiss.
Although they cut away.
They do. I know. It's like the book fades to black.
Yeah.
Like, give me that kiss.
He says like, I'm going to give her this one moment of privacy or whatever.
I don't know. You're like, okay, that's respectful. That said, give me that kiss.
Yeah.
And I like that Sunny learns how to prepare locks.
Yes,
it is. And I like the dress. Oh, I used to be obsessed with Esme Squalor's dress
that looks like fire. and then the Hunger Games said, I like that idea. I'll take it.
I see your fire dress.
What if the fire dress was on a good girl? Instead of a bad girl, a good girl.
Changing the narrative around fire dresses. Yeah, those are, they're all, the middle section is really good. And then the beginning and the end are kind of boring.
One day someone will rewrite these books when that becomes socially acceptable. Or like, it'll be like Peter Pan, you know, like where someone like
it becomes public domain and then you can just.
Yeah.
I'm assuming they will be making an all-athlete movie of it per this like, podcast.
I mean, that's just good business.
The Space Jam version of Series of Unfortunate Events.
Wait, all basketball Series of Unfortunate Events is an amazing idea.
Including
the basketball kids. Players also need to play the children.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just shorter basketball players generally will play the kids. Let's all collaborate on
Let's all connect on this.
Dreamcasting.
I wish I knew
we already know
any single basketball player.
I know. I'm like, Larry Bird. Larry Bird, Yao Ming, Johnson, Shaquille O'Neal, and
KG.
We have a section that we're kind of like toying with. We want to recognize that, like, you know, not every author that we read a book from is going to be like a perfect person, which is fine. But, you know, sometimes they've done shitty things that we probably should recognize, even if they're not like total monsters, you know? And so this section is the author a literal war criminal? For Daniel Handler, whose pen name is Lemony Snicket, he is not a literal war criminal.
No,
that
being
said,
he is some.
He is some other things, though.
Yeah, my thing with him, because it's like he's made like racist comments, and then he got like low level Me Too'd as well in a way that was totally justified. Yeah. Like, I'm like, what have you done to improve? Like, what did you do to improve? How have you changed?
Yeah.
Because I'm glad that he hasn't done anything horrible since that we know. But it's like, what did he do to change? I don't know.
It was interesting because in his apology, he was like, I'm a survivor of sexual abuse. And that does not at all, you know, like, mean he gets a pass. But I think that one thing is that, you know, when you have survived something like that, because like what he's accused of is like being inappropriately sexual, like making jokes that were sexual jokes that were like made people really uncomfortable. And I do think that when you've survived something like that, and I took from that is it might have been a childhood thing, that it is hard to have a grasp of that stuff that other people do. You know, it becomes a little bit separated, like dissociated in some way. So that doesn't excuse him, but I'm just saying, like, it's a weird thing because it's like, yeah, what have you done? Because this is a moment where I think he could improve. He could he could deal with. And at least he apologized and it seemed like a real apology, but
I don't think he's irredeemable, and I just I hope that like sometime soon we'll have like a more clarity on like what that looks like for him. I don't know.
I Googled him. Not to brag. But I
See, I also did I didn't Google, so I'm
been giving a lot of money to charities. To to help with people as they're dealing with COVID stuff, you know. So cool.
Recent.
He wrote a book about being a waiter during COVID and stuff. I don't know. I haven't looked too much into that.
I have not. Yeah, I also heard of it, but I'm like, that could go a lot of
ways. There's
it's one of those things where like he seems to still be accepted by the community. And that certainly is not mean he has done the work. But it also does it mean nothing? I don't know. It's perplexing.
I feel like we just don't have enough information. Yeah. I'm like cautiously optimistic for him. Because he has definitely fucked up majorly. His journey has been so bizarre because I feel like he used to kind of be, as far as like children's authors went, he definitely was like an edgelord for children.
That's a good way to put like, it, I guess.
He like recommended Lolita in Nickelodeon magazine.
No!
Definitely not smart. Yeah.
What? So okay, that, like, that actually changes my opinion.
War criminal.
I think he might be a war criminal. I guess for this, we're not even trying to like make a solid judgment as much as just be like, when we're talking about this author's work, you know, recognize that like the position that this work put him in did cause harm to some people. Like, the point of this is we just want to recognize that and do our due diligence. And we're not trying to pass judgment as much as just recognize that. This is pretty clear, I think. But our last little question is, did we like the book? Does I think the answer is yes. But after did the Daniel Handler recommending Lolita in Nick magazine your view a little bit?
I will say I'm still cross-checking that it was actually Nickelodeon magazine, but it was a children's magazine.
Like Highlights.
Yeah, Highlights would be so funny. Highlights would be so funny.
Yeah.
I really hope he redeems himself, but you just never know.
And all he needs to do to redeem himself is simply write the great American novel. You know?
That's all we're chasing.
You're telling me The Bad Beginning is not the great American novel?
I would call it the great American novella, personally.
It's so annoying to me when someone knows all they have to do is write the great American novel and they don't do it.
It's
like you could save us all so much.
It's like, just write the great
just
American
do
novel.
It. It would be so much easier for everybody, but whatever.
It's embarrassing people don't do it.
It's like kind of frustrating and like I try to like whatever, but I think I did like the book. Definitely as a kid reading it, I loved the book. So to the question, did I like it when I read it?
Yeah.
I was so into it when I was a kid. So
it's one of those books that reading it when I was a kid made me feel smart.
Yes.
You know, like it made me feel like smart and more knowledgeable about the world. And like, I knew how wicked everybody was, you know?
Right. It followed in the great tradition of like the monster at the end of this book. If you guys read that.
Yeah.
Where it was like a book that didn't want to be read. And I was like, when you're reading a book and it says, stop. Don't read this. It's like so thrilling.
I would love to talk to someone who, as a child, legitimately stopped reading.
It's like of
unfortunate events.
They're out there. You have to.
I gotta,
it was just such a fun fourth wall break.
I'm still so embarrassingly attached to these books. I like have the tattoo and I just, yes! That's it. And I still love them. I really hope that Daniel Handler can keep his act together because I like this tattoo.
Yeah, I think it's okay to still have the tattoo.
Totally.
I've, as someone who's had to have tattoos covered up, I think you're still good.
It's my most high risk tattoo unless the Zamboni company gets
big Zamboni.
Big Zamboni. If Zamboni ends up being like, you know, Wall Street,
if
then I'll have to have my Zamboni covered up, and I have no idea how I would do that.
If every Zamboni turns out to have little children on the inside operating,
if Zamboni like is Pizzagate,
bicycles, So, series of unfortunate events, definitely my most high risk tattoo. But so far, it's in an okay zone.
Yeah, great. Awesome. So we all liked it.
We all loved it. I mean, we had many notes throughout the podcast, but for right now, at the end, no notes. Okay, so this has been the first episode of Competitive Literature. We're gonna
Grace won.
I won. My name is Grace Thomas. I'm a winner.
I'm Julie, and I'm a loser.
We're gonna put these out once a week, and we are excited for you to eventually subscribe to our Patreon.
You can now turn off your flashlight under the covers while you're listening to this podcast and go to sleep.
That's good. We'll see if we say that in the next one. But thank you so much, Jamie, for being on this podcast.
Thank you for having me. For being this on the so
pod.
Fun.
Our first friend of the pod, Jamie Loftus.
Wow.
Jamie has a brand new podcast. By the time this comes out, it will probably have came out. But it's about Lolita. And I'm very excited to listen to it. Where can people check it out, and what's it called?
It's called Lolita Podcast, to keep things simple. Yeah, it comes out every week on Mondays starting November 23rd. It's 9 episodes long, so it'll be coming out into January. And yeah, it's about how Daniel Handler recommended Lolita. And I read it when I was 12 and I didn't understand it. And so this is just like an entire podcast tracing like who is actually the character of Lolita and why does everyone treat her so badly in culture.
Incredible.
And that's it.
That sounds very cool. And also, spoiler alert, you can hear my voice on a couple of the episodes. So I'm excited.
Yeah.
If you're a fan of this voice, which I don't know why you would, it's very loud and gravelly, but also trill at the same time.
In the pod. So,
it's a beautiful paradox that
I'm just excited. I did some accent work that wasn't asked for in some of the lines, and I'm excited to see if those are the lines that get in.
Amazing. Thank you.
So can people just listen to it on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and whatnot?
Yeah, all the regular places. It's called Lolita Podcast. It's on Spotify and Apple and Stitcher and all the places you can get stuff. It will be there.
Awesome.
Yay! Yeah.
What a pod.
What a pod it's been.
Well, I guess
I do what I'm doing.
I guess that it's time for us to sail off in a boat with a little baby that's popped up as we've done this spot. All right, this is the end. Bye.